cold air and bits of linen on the ground in Kyiv. Today, Monday, December 9th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The protests continue in Ukraine. One protester in Kyiv has mixed feelings about the toppling of a Lenin statue there over the weekend.
That's an act of vandalism, clearly. But honestly, the first thing that I thought, at last.
By the way, how many more Lenin statues are there?
There is one in a casino in Las Vegas, another in a casino in Atlantic City. My favorite is the one that is in front of the Kremlin Bar in Belfast.
Plus, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un gives his uncle the boot.
Not only had he been removed from all of his posts, but his name is removed from the Workers' Party of Korea, which means, in layman terms, he's toast.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. East is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. Nice saying, perhaps, but in Ukraine, east and west are locked in a tug of war. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in Kyiv over the weekend made clear they want closer ties with the West, or at least the European Union. Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, has other ideas. He's turned the nation's back on the EU and renewed Ukraine's ties to its eastern neighbor, Russia. Today, there were signs that the government was starting to crack down on protesters. Earlier, I spoke with Anastasia Melnik in Kyiv. She's a presenter with Espresso TV, a news channel that sympathizes with the protesters.
Well, today was the worst day, I guess, because after the mass demonstrations, it was like we don't know what to expect because we expect some force involved from the country and from the ruling party in particular. So people on the streets are really scared right now. That I can say it's pretty peaceful, but it's not that easy.
Now, let's make this clear. I mean, you're kind of a partisan in this fight, even though you're a news presenter, Anastasia. Have you been out in the streets demonstrating with those demonstrators?
Yeah, sure. That's what I'm doing every day after work. I mean, I'm hosting the morning show, so I work from 5 a.m. till 10. And so after 10, I'm constantly on the street. Yesterday, I was on the streets too. It was incredible on the streets. I mean, so many people.
The protesters, we've read, toppled a statue of Vladimir Lenin yesterday in Kyiv. Why topple the statue of Lenin? What was the symbolism, do you think?
Well, the symbolism was that, let's say, Lenin wasn't the best person for the Ukrainian history, and most of the monuments were gone long time ago.
What did you think when the statue was brought down and, you know, destroyed in pretty dramatic fashion?
Well, right now I would say that's an act of vandalism, clearly. But honestly, the first thing that I thought, at last, that's not a monument that should be in Kyiv. I realize that's a good memory of a lot of people, the Soviet Union, but I also realize how much did Ukraine suffer because of that. You know, that's the same thing for me personally as putting the monument of Hitler on the Red Square.
Anastasia, what do your parents make of these protests and your participation in them?
Well, my parents, my mom and part of my family lives in Belgium, but they are protesting in Brussels, actually. And my dad, he's every day on the demonstrations, too. So they're also actively taking part in that.
What do you hope comes out of this?
First of all, I hope for the change of the powers. I don't have so much trust in the opposition, because we already had this failed revolution, failed orange revolution. People got what they wanted, but it failed, obviously. And right now, I think that's a perfect chance, even if we don't really have that, you know, one leader that we want to see. And for me, this community, this involvement of the community, this changing in consciousness of people, that's what's important.
And finally, Anastasia, in an already frigid city like Kyiv, now there's a driving snow. How are you demonstrators staying warm?
There's this helping places where people share warm clothes, socks, anything that you need. Like, they cook, we have soups, everything. And students, a lot of students of my university and other universities, just taking money and just going and buying everything that people need.
Anastasia Melnik, a news presenter at Espresso TV in Kyiv. She's also been demonstrating in the streets as well. Thanks very much, Anastasia.
Thank you.
Back to that Lenin statue in Kyiv. Kind of surprising that it would still be there in post-Soviet Ukraine at all. But then again, there are Lenin statues in all sorts of odd places around the globe. And Professor Vlad Godzish at the University of California, Santa Cruz, knows where many of them are.
We can find them almost all over the world, most obviously in Russia, and particularly in Moscow. There are over 80 of them still standing. What's surprising about the Ukraine is that while it has taken a number of them down, including the one this weekend, it has also built two new ones in the past 6 years, so that it's bucking the trend. Now, if you want some other ones, there is one in a casino in Las Vegas, another in a casino in Atlantic City. My favorite is the one that is in front of the Kremlin Bar in Belfast. Huh. It's a gay bar, and they are very proud of having a statue of Lenin there. And in a suburb of Seattle, they have a huge one that they imported from Slovakia, which they dress up usually in, sadomasochistic clothing or long dresses and so on, particularly at the time of the gay pride parades. So there's a kind of a kitschiness to some of these at the present time. I think of them as the equivalent of people putting on a Che Guevara t-shirt under a tuxedo to go to a formal dinner. But you also find some that are still left over from the commitment to communist ideology. In Vietnam, for example, you find one like that. In France, there is one in front of the Communist Party headquarters in the city of Montpellier. And you find some in Bulgaria, but I think they are planning to take those down. Right. In the rest of Eastern Europe, they've disappeared. They've just been knocked down instantly.
So what are some of his different poses and what do they represent? I know, you know, there's obviously a famous one of him pointing kind of off into the future. How else has he been depicted?
The most common one is to show him as a thoughtful man. And this is the busts that are used in front of Communist Party headquarters generally. Another pose, which is quite the opposite of the one where he is pointing, is to depict him with his arms behind his back and just standing as if he had no direction to show, but rather was addressing people in a very matter-of-fact way. So that's not Lenin the leader, but rather Lenin the imminent permanence of the revolution among people. And that's a very important thing, and that is that when these statues were being proliferated, the idea was that wherever you would turn, there would be Lenin with you. So that Lenin was not transcendental, but imminent to the world. That's why they put him in coal mines, they put him in lakes, they put him in rivers, on mountaintops, everywhere. Mm. So it was like, you know, the equivalent of an imminent god who actually, you know, can look at you in this way. And in that position, he was not the leader of the revolution pointing to the future, but rather just with his hands behind his back, the inspector of reality.
Right. I mean, you just listed such a crazy mix of places where you could find Lenin statues. And I suppose what it means to the people where they live depends on where we're talking about. But is there a common thread today that kind of connects all these disparate countries and places where you find Lenin statues for the people who look at Lenin and what he means to them?
I think by and large, people ignore them, even in the places where there are still very, very large statues. It's a little bit like the inhabitants of Rio de Janeiro. They do see this huge statue of Christ on the hill, looking at the bay, and they most of the time they don't talk about it, and if you draw their attention to it and say, well, it's time that he took the plunge. And you have the same kind of an attitude toward the Lenin statues. I think that on some occasions, the anniversary of the revolution, you do have people who have a certain kind of nostalgia for the old order. And these are mostly people who were retired or who are heroes of World War II. They come bedecked with all of their medals. And they look at Lenin as an indication of the history and the continuity of the country in one in which they played a heroic role.
Vlad Godzich, professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thanks very much.
You're quite welcome.
We've mapped the locations of many of the world's remaining Lenin statues in case you need to find one. Check that out at PRI.org. And later in the show, a little story about another Lenin statue, the late Beatle, that is. Stick around for that. Now, the protests in Ukraine have a special resonance in Russia, and not just because they have to do with Russia's relations with Ukraine. In 2011 and 2012, thousands of Russians demonstrated in similar fashion to what we're seeing in Kiev now. Those Russian protesters were demanding free and fair elections. They wore white ribbons to symbolize their cause, and they saw the inevitable re-election of Vladimir Putin as a sign that the campaign was not fair. Svetlana Kolesnikova was a protester in that white ribbon movement. She also just happened to be in Kiev last week. I asked her what it's like to see the protests in Ukraine unfold.
It is very inspiring and a little, you know, jealous in good way. I'm happy for them and jealous. I mean that I would like to have the same amount of people and the same, you know, quality of protest. So I feel happy and I would like to see this, I don't know, level of responsibility for the country where you live in Russia someday.
Why do you think that is? Why is this not happening in Russia?
I can't tell why, but maybe because mostly people, they don't see that there is use in this street protest. Maybe they just, they were on the big protests once and twice, and they say, well, why would I go there again? It's useless.
How would you like to see it happen in Russia?
I'm not sure when, I'm not sure how. I hope that someday there will be some, you know, changes. There will be some, maybe this street protest, maybe something else. I'm not sure. But what inspires me most is, you know, consciousness of Ukraine people. They know that they are in charge of what's going on in their country. And in Russia, even if something is wrong with the country, even if something is bad, it doesn't mean that I can do anything to change the situation. So people don't believe in themselves, don't believe that they are responsible for the country where they live. That's the main trouble. not enough people who realize that they can do a lot. And if there were crowds of these people, we would do anything.
Svetlana Kolesnikova, who was protesting in the White Ribbon Movement in Moscow last year, who just came back from Kiev. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Svetlana.
Thank you.
There are lots of new ways to find the world, including our new digital home, PRI.org. One other great way is with the Flipboard app. It runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device, and here's what it does. It turns this radio show into a magazine, and all the stories, you can flip through them like pages in a magazine, and you can still hear all the voices you know from the world. You can find that at flipboard.com/the world. Later on The World, the spy who came in from the World of Warcraft on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. One of North Korea's top officials has been dramatically and publicly purged from office. Jong Song-taek was considered number two in the system by some observers. More than that, he's the uncle of Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. The Hermit Kingdom usually keeps its politics behind closed doors, so the televised purge of Uncle Zhang is almost unprecedented. Robert Carlin is a former top State Department intelligence analyst on North Korea. He's been looking at the images released today by North Korea's state media.
It was quite a piece of theater. He was unceremoniously escorted from the meeting room by a couple of guards. They announced that not only had he been removed from all of his posts, but his name is removed from the Workers' Party of Korea, which means he's now a non-person. In layman terms, he's toast.
Toast. Well, he wasn't toast a while ago. He seemed to be kind of like the number two and a big advisor to Kim Jong-un. I mean, who is Jang Song-taek? How important was he?
First of all, he's an uncle of Kim Jong-un. He's married to Kim Jong-un's aunt, so he's not a blood relation. It's a relation by marriage. Jang Song-taek has been around for a long time. He's been up and down in the leadership several times. People who have met him have been quite impressed. He's very intelligent. He's interested in new economic ideas. But he's also apparently, and I've never met him, so I'm just repeating what I've heard, but he's also apparently someone who has a little bit of a strut to his walk.
Meaning what?
He plays it close to the acceptable line in terms of personality and personal lifestyle. In other words, he oversteps the bounds. That's why he's been knocked down before, but he's always come back. I don't think he's coming back this time.
I mean, is it kind of plausible that he would be purged because he's got swagger?
Well, in North Korea, if you have swagger, there's an implication that somehow you're almost on par with the leader, especially if people gather around you so that you have something that looks like a faction. Faction is an incredibly dirty word in North Korea. And that's the main charge against him in the Bill of Particulars that was read out at this meeting, that he formed a faction.
Why is the word faction such a dirty word? I mean, what does that imply? What's it code for?
It implies that there's an alternate power center, in effect, that there are a group of people who effectively can counter the views of the supreme leader, and that cannot be allowed to continue.
So you imply, Robert Carlin, that we probably won't see this uncle again. What might happen to him?
The fact that they showed him at the meeting and escorted him out but didn't mention anything more serious was going to happen to him could just be that he's going to go into a long, long-time house arrest in the countryside somewhere. His underlings may face much more serious punishment, and that has apparently already happened to some of them.
And what does it suggest to you about Kim Jong-un? More competent than we thought, or just surrounded by extremely clever aides?
There were people who, as soon as, on the outside observers, who as soon as Kim Jong-un took over, said he's not going to last very long. He won't last, 6 months, a year, whatever. Well, here we are 2 years into his reign, and he's still there. Not only that, he looks to be stronger than ever. So I think this is one more sign that he's competent, that his father trained him very well, and that he was more ready to take over than outsiders expected. It doesn't mean he can't stumble at some point, but so far he's done a very good job and understands the levers of power in his country.
Robert Carlin, a former senior State Department intelligence analyst on North Korea. An updated edition of his History of Korea, The Two Koreas, is published tomorrow. Robert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
An ancient symbol of human rights just wrapped up its first U.S. tour. It's a Cyrus cylinder, a small piece of clay from ancient Persia, but it's inscribed with what's believed to be the first human rights charter in writing. Persian King Cyrus the Great wrote the charter in the year 539 BC after the conquest of Babylon. The Cyrus cylinder was on display at the Getty Villa in Los Angeles, a city that's home to the largest community of Iranians outside of Iran. The world's Sonia Narang went to the exhibit to speak with some of them about the tour.
Since its discovery more than 100 years ago, the clay cylinder has become an iconic artifact for Iranians. It seems especially meaningful for Iranian expats here. As soon as I walked into the exhibit, I saw a woman wiping her eyes.
I burst into tears. I got so excited, and something inside me just reacted. I don't know, maybe it's Iranian blood? I don't know.
Zora Sadrzadeh stood in front of the cylinder with her college-age daughter, Roxanne, the first generation in her family to grow up in the U.S.
All of a sudden, I turn around and I see that she's got tears running down her face as she's staring at it and just overwhelmed. And I saw another daughter with her mom saying, yeah, my mom had the same reaction. Yeah, it was very overwhelming for her.
What does the Sire cylinder mean to you personally?
I think it's just a reminder of how much influence Persia had on the world. There's a lot of awe and respect for it. It's a big deal to see something part of my heritage that I don't get to see very often.
Zora said the cylinder meant even more to her because of the political situation in her country.
Cyrus is the father of Iran, and the fact that he wrote this Declaration of Human Rights and the fact that Iranians don't have basic human rights in Iran, maybe that's another reason. I couldn't control myself. I started crying.
Ali Hajimiri also brought his children. He left Iran at the age of 22, and now he teaches engineering at Caltech. He talked proudly about Cyrus the Great's legacy.
The conqueror used to completely take over everything and subjugate the people around them. And when Cyrus came to power, considering how vast the empire became, at the Persian Empire at the time, I think he realized that that model is not going to work. Arguably, it was one of the first true empires, in the sense that he gave the local people the ability to have self-governance to some extent.
Bahman Fati, who's lived in L.A. since 1977, says he's thrilled to see the cylinder. And he says he thinks cultural exchanges like this exhibit can help change Americans' negative views about Iran.
This tour has been very successful in a way to introducing Iranians in the end as peace-loving people like many other people around the world, which I think they are.
The Cyrus cylinder is scheduled to head to Mumbai before returning to the U.K., where it's a part of the British Museum's permanent collection. Some of the expats here say they'd like to see the cylinder go on exhibit in Iran again, so that more people there could see this part of their history. For The World, I'm Sonia Narang, Los Angeles.
You can see the Cyrus cylinder on our website. We have pictures at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, the many languages of South Africa.
Our little girl is 8 months old. We're very conscious of having her learn Xhosa, Zulu, and then English. So when I get home, I'll read an English story to her, and then Daddy will read a Xhosa story to her.
How languages unite but also divide the new South Africa, just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Enough with all the data mining. That's what Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and several other U.S. companies seem to say today. The tech giants wrote an open letter to the White House and Congress asking them to curb the NSA surveillance of their users' information. A few more tech companies might want to add their names to that letter, like the developers of the video games World of Warcraft and Second Life. Today's New York Times reports that U.S. and British spies actually infiltrated those games in search of terrorist activity. That's info based on, you guessed it, more leaked surveillance documents. Mark Mazzetti co-authored the Times story.
The concern back in 2007, 2008 was that these worlds were kind of unregulated and could be used as safe havens for groups who might want to plan attacks. So in other words, if you're in World of Warcraft and you're a terrorist, you would be, in theory, talking about some kind of fantasy thing with another terrorist, but you would then be using that as code to plot an actual attack.
Right. So they might be saying to one another, don't hide behind the big rock. And that might be code for something.
Yes, exactly. You know, not only communication, but also these virtual worlds like Second Life and World of Warcraft have their own currencies. And the worry was that these currencies could be used to somehow move money in ways that was outside of the view of normal financial regulations.
I mean, it sounds plausible and kind of theoretical. What did they actually find?
Well, it's hard from the documents to see any kind of actual evidence that that terrorists had, in fact, infiltrated these worlds. We talked to current and former officials. We also talked to outside experts, and some people pointed out that, you know, if you are a terrorist, this is not the safest place for you to be operating in, because these worlds, if you just take World of Warcraft, for instance, there is a decent amount of regulation of these games just by the companies themselves. The companies monitor traffic. The companies monitor financial activity. So if you're going to want to hide somewhere in some corner of the internet, this is not necessarily the safest place to do it.
What's really absurd, and you describe this in your New York Times story, is that there were so many agents from so many agencies playing around and snooping on these games that they actually had to develop another system to identify each other because they were virtually bumping into each other in these games. did anyone give you examples of these awkward moments?
No, but there's mention in a document about the need for a deconfliction group, which means that some group that would cut across all these various agencies that would allow them to know which digital avatar was actually a CIA officer, which gnome might be a FBI agent. And so that was just sort of a sign about how much all these different agencies saw these virtual worlds as, quote, an opportunity.
Have any suspects been apprehended or even zeroed in on based on intelligence gathered from these gaming sites?
There is mention in one of the documents about in Britain, there was a criminal network that had moved its operations into Second Life, and that the London police had used a digital informant inside Second Life, which helped them sort of gather information about this criminal network. Not much more we know about that operation. And beyond that, it's hard to know about any real specific operations that have been launched or thwarted in these virtual worlds.
Now, you tell the story, Mark, of the former chief operation officer at Second Life in San Francisco, a guy named Corey Ondrejka, who's now at Facebook. He was, in fact, a former Navy officer who had worked in the NSA. He had top secret security clearance. Is that typical, this revolving door between intelligence and the online gaming world?
It's hard to know how typical it is. I mean, certainly, you know, if you're a gaming company or you're a tech company and you're the NSA, you're going to try to, some degree, recruit from the same pool, people who have technical skills, math skills, programming skills. Now that the tech companies are under a certain degree of heat for what they are or are not doing with intelligence agencies, I mean, my guess is there might be some greater scrutiny of who joins the tech companies.
It does feel kind of like grasping for straws with the NSA snooping in the gaming world, but there is a link that is not totally fantasy. I mean, apparently Hezbollah created a video game.
Outside of the pure surveillance aspect of this, video games have been used for essentially propaganda purposes. Hezbollah has had games that they are trying to market to young people in the Middle East that advance their own propaganda agendas. In the latter part of the last decade, the Pentagon actually developed online games for propaganda and intelligence gathering purposes that were designed by European tech companies, but the purpose was to get people to play them without identifying them as American government products. In other words, get your messages to the gamer subtly without saying these are made by the USA.
So what questions are you left with? And is this still going on?
My sense is that this is probably still going on. The NSA and American and British intelligence agencies told us very little when we put questions to them about it. I still have questions about exactly what they may have found out in these worlds. After all of this enthusiasm in 2007 and 2008, whether the terrorists were there or not.
Mark Mazzetti, a journalist with the New York Times. He's also the author of The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark, for this discussion, it's game over. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Let's stick with video games for our next story. It's part of a collaboration we have with Radio Ambulante. Ambulante's founder is the novelist Daniel Alarcón, so I'll let him introduce the story.
This is a story about games, specifically something that interests me quite a bit as a storyteller, as a novelist. This new kind of interactive game that functions almost like a novel. I sort of compare them to those choose-your-own-adventure stories that I used to read when I was a kid that I loved a lot. And I just think that there's an entire type of gaming now that is borrowing quite a bit from, you know, more sophisticated storytelling that is not just shoot 'em up kind of stuff. And in the case of this game, Papo y Yo, we have a game designer who tried to create a really complex and sophisticated story about alcoholism and poverty in Latin America.
And here's reporter Nancy Lopez on this new type of game and its designer.
Van der Caballero saw that his idea for a new kind of video game could work after he talked to his mentor, Nilo Rodas. Rodas worked on the visual effects for the original Star Trek trilogy. Caballero opened up to him about growing up in Colombia with an alcoholic father and his idea for a video game based on that.
And then Nilo looked at me and said, like, look, Vander, don't take this the wrong way, but your story has been told 1,000 times. You just have to figure out how to use the skills you have with this new medium and tell it. And at that moment, I realized that I actually can take my suffering and my hurt and transform it into something positive for others.
So Caballero quit his job at a major game developer and launched Minority Media, a company based in Montreal that's focused less on shoot 'em up games and more on offering players something a bit more meaningful, like the game Caballero recently created. It's called Papo y Yo, or Dad and Me in Spanish.
I went to the game that would have served me when I was a kid.
To understand how Papo y Yo works, let's start with Caballero's childhood. He grew up in the 80s in Bogotá, when it was a battleground for drug cartels. Caballero's family was wealthy and pretty walled off from the violence. But Caballero faced another type of threat at home.
It was really, really hard to go to sleep after 8 o'clock if my father hadn't arrived home. Because if he hadn't arrived by 8, that meant that he was drinking. It was really terrible because I was just waiting for the electric garage door to open to start figuring out what I'm going to do, what I'm going to hide.
Caballero took refuge in games, like Mario Brothers.
I remember that I spent days and nights trying to defeat Bonser, who was the evil guy. But then when I put the controller down, I came back to my reality and say that game didn't give me any clue whatsoever on how to cope with an alcoholic father.
It's the premise of Papo y Yo, where the main character, a boy named Kiko, is trying to survive a monster's destructive behavior. It's a tension that resonates with fans of the game, like Vince Osorio.
So this is one of the more, it seems, I guess, tougher puzzles here, but all right, so there's Monster, there's Kiko.
Osorio is maneuvering the game at his home near San Francisco. On the screen, Kiko runs through a colorful favela in Brazil. The monster, who's at least 5 times bigger, tumbles closely behind. Osorio is 24 and designs mobile apps. He's also a longtime gamer and wasn't sure what to expect from Papo y Yo, especially after seeing the game's opening quote. It states, "To my mother, brothers, and sisters, with whom I survived the monster in my father. Signed, Vander."
I remember just taking a step back and just saying, whoa, like, I didn't think we were going to go there. I didn't know this was that type of game or this was the material that this game was going to approach.
Osorio realized the game's actually about the changing relationship between Kiko and the monster. How Kiko sometimes needs the monster's help, or how the mood can quickly get pretty dark. At one point, Monster lunges at Kiko, grabs him by the mouth, and ejects him across a large field.
So he disappeared. There are the frogs. There's a palpable sense of danger in that, like, that there's a character that just turns on a dime and just completely just obliterates you when they get the chance, but doesn't kill you, which might actually be scarier. Come on, monster.
For Caballero, the game's creator, feeling that sense of danger, how he felt with his dad at times, is what he's going for in Papo y Yo. And the game's caught on. It's been a PlayStation hit, won awards, and Caballero has been blown away by letters from players worldwide thanking him for creating games like this. Caballero recalls one letter he got from a single father in the U.S.
He told us that sometimes when he was really stressed and he screamed to his kid. And then playing Papo, he realized how his kid felt. And at that point, it really touched me deeply because I thought that I would be able only to touch the victims.
It's a response that's motivating Caballero and his company to create more games based on real lived experiences. His team's now working on a game called Silent Enemy about bullying. For The World, I'm Nancy Lopez.
Okay, guys, have a nice ride. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
So, you scared of heights? I ask because I've got a new world quiz here that's going to test your acrophobia. You know zip lines, right? You harness yourself up and then let gravity take over for a bit of a thrill ride. You zoom down, usually past some trees, through some trees, no big deal. But what you're hearing right now is a sound from a camera mounted on the harness of one of the wildest zip line rides in the world. It's more than a mile long and features a vertical drop of almost 2,000 feet.
You reach speeds up to 85 to 90 miles per hour.
And don't close your eyes, because all the way down, you're looking at the Himalayas. So, where are we? Well, let's see. If you're doing 80 down the zip line, I'm going to give you about 600 feet to answer the quiz. That's about 5 seconds for the mathematically challenged. Okay, this zip line is located in Nepal, in a place called Pokhara, to be exact. Abhinav Churiwal is with High Ground Adventures, which runs the Zip Flyer.
The experience is just amazing. We have those electronic gates that open up when you launch, and as soon as you are there on the ride, you feel you're airborne. You know, you get a feeling of a wind gushing on your face, and you know it's like a feeling that you feel like you're flying. You know, when we started running trials, we used dead weights. But then I was the second human trial for the zip line, and I was scared at that time. But then as I did it, it was amazing. I mean, there's a 180 degree view, so you see the complete Himalayan range while you're zipping down. The best time of the day to try it would be sunrise. You see the sun rays on the Himalayas, so it all looks orange. And just imagine you're zipping down while watching the sunrise. I mean, that would be the best time, around 6 o'clock in the morning. We had a 65-year-old lady who went on the zip line. And I could see, like, from 50 meters away, she had a bright smile on her face. And as soon as she entered the landing platform, we took her off the harness. And all she said, "God bless you, my children. And this is one of the best rides I've ever had." It made everyone's day, yeah.
Abhinav Churiwal of High Ground Adventures in Nepal. He was telling us about the Zip Flyer, one of the world's most extreme zipline adventures. You'll want to see some videos of the ride, and yes, we have them at PRI.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. World leaders are on their way to Soweto, South Africa, for tomorrow's memorial for Nelson Mandela. Nearly 100 heads of state will be there, including Barack Obama. Joining him will be former presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. Soweto is South Africa's best-known township and the scene of many of the most famous episodes in the struggle against apartheid. One of those episodes concerned language, the language that classes would be taught in schools. In 1976, school children in Soweto rioted in protest against the Afrikaans language. Very few black South Africans spoke Afrikaans at home. It was the language of the white Afrikaners who ruled South Africa. Yet in schools in Soweto and elsewhere, kids were taught in Afrikaans.
This is where I was born. This is where I grew up.
The BBC's Milton Nkosi is from Soweto, and his high school was right across the street from Nelson Mandela's old home.
A lot has changed and a lot hasn't changed. I remember, you see this square here, we used to play chess here. But the children in their curriculum, they now learn languages without having to learn Afrikaans.
When South Africa went through its momentous changes in the 1990s, the issue of language was one of its greatest challenges. Afrikaans was a symbol of identity for the white Afrikaners. The language had come into being in the 17th century when Dutch settlers arrived in Africa. During apartheid, Afrikaans was one of South Africa's two official languages. The other was English. After apartheid, and after Nelson Mandela was elected president, debate began over what a new constitution should say about languages. Afrikaans was despised by many, loved by a few, says constitutional lawyer and one-time ANC dissident Albie Sachs.
Language for the Afrikaner nationalists had been central to their identity, their being, their struggle, and they could just about imagine conceding democracy and could just about imagine a constitution in which black and white were equal. But if Afrikaans was downgraded, boom.
It would have been popular to strip Afrikaans and even English of their status as official languages, but the framers of South Africa's new constitution, including Albie Sachs, knew they had to strike a different kind of balance.
No language rights already existing in South Africa should be diminished, which meant the status of English and Afrikaans would not be reduced. But the language rights of the great majority of the people who'd been marginalized, their rights had to be upgraded. And in two sentences, we had solved the basic dilemma of the language question in South Africa. No language is more important than any other language.
That's an ideal, of course, but it's an ideal that two decades later, some South Africans have taken to heart.
My name is Phumza Fihlani. Our little girl is 8 months old. We're very conscious of having her learn Xhosa, Zulu, and then English. So when I get home, if I'm reading a story to her, I'll read an English story to her, and then Daddy will read a Xhosa story to her. But we're very conscious of having her exposed to those three languages at this point.
Once South Africa's youngest generation grows up, though, they'll find that all languages are not equal. It's one thing to enshrine equality in a constitution, another one to enforce it in the workplace, for example, or schools. Listen to this middle-class South African parent.
There's a huge controversy in South Africa among educated classes of black people where everybody finds themselves in this difficulty where their children are speaking English to them because they send them to good schools, and the good schools invariably are English-speaking schools, and so they have to talk in English with their children. And suddenly, you drive half an hour down the motorway to where the parent grew up, and they greet the kid in an African language, and the kid speaks like a total stranger. Daddy, what are they saying? And a lot of that is so painful because the people at the parents' home, the relatives and the friends, they resent that.
And there are other resentments. Native Afrikaans and English speakers are resented for not learning indigenous languages, even at the most elementary level. And by the way, because Afrikaans is still one of South Africa's 11 official languages, Afrikaans can be the language of instruction at some schools. These schools generally appeal to Afrikaners, not blacks, and they can look like throwbacks to the apartheid era. Critics say that communities that don't want to integrate hide behind the official status of the Afrikaans language. These arguments are a measure of how languages can both knit people together and divide them. We have more on South Africa's languages in the latest edition of our podcast, The World in Words. You can hear about one man's quest to come up with new 21st century words for South Africa's most widely spoken language, Zulu. You can find all that at pri.org/language. You hear stories sometimes, and it's as if they were lifted from a movie. This one feels like it came straight from a Fellini film. Earlier, we told you about the Lenin statue torn down during those demonstrations in Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Well, now let's talk about the statue of Lenin in Havana. John Lennon, as in the late Beatle. Different spelling altogether. It's a bronze statue, but Lenin's trademark National Health granny glasses are real. Or rather, they were real. You see, they kept getting stolen by visitors who wanted a souvenir. Until 13 years ago. That's when a retired man across the street from the park took on a new volunteer job. He's done it 4 days a week, every week since. Juan Gonzalez sits next to John Lennon's statue with his own wire-rimmed glasses. When tourists come by to take pictures, Gonzalez places his glasses on John Lennon. And when the snapshots are done, he puts his glasses back in his pocket next to his cigars and sits back down. Juan Gonzalez is now 95. Apparently, he didn't really know John Lennon's music when Lennon was alive. But since Gonzalez moved to Havana from the Cuban countryside 20 years ago to be with his daughter, he's become a Beatles fan. As he told the Associated Press, "All the foreigners that come here sit with me and take pictures. I am in every country in the world." I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. Leaving you in Havana with the other Lennon today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow. Well, I tell them there's no problem.
only solutions. Well, they shake their heads and they look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry, I'm just sitting here doing time.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.